Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers,
and from the law firm of Primer, Piper, Eggleston, and Kramer, providing comprehensive legal counsel to New Hampshire businesses and their owners for more than 30 years. For more information or to speak to an attorney, visit primer.com. And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own-farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's called the summer slide, but you won't find it at a playground or a water park. The term refers to the learning that kids tend to lose over summer vacation. Many New Hampshire libraries try to pick up the slack with special reading programs, and schools and parents do what they can. But this year, the state's Department of Education is stepping up its efforts to counter summer learning loss. And today in The Exchange, we find out more, and let's hear from you. What are your observations about the summer slide? How big a problem do you think it really is? And what's the best way to approach this? Let us know. Send us an email. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We have three guests. Tanya Sturtz is here, Associate Dean of the School of Arts, Education, and Culture at Keene State College. She's also an Associate Professor of Special Education. And Tanya, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Also with us, Andrew Coppins, Assistant Professor of Learning Sciences at UNH. And Andrew, nice to meet you. Thank you for being here as
well.
My
pleasure. Thank you.
And also with us, Christine Brennan, Deputy Commissioner at the New Hampshire Department of Education. She worked in education in Manchester for many years as a first grade teacher, a literacy specialist, and a principal. And Christine, welcome back. Thank you very much for being here.
Thanks so much for having us. I'm excited to talk about this important topic.
Well, and Christine, I do want to turn to you first, but not so much in that role right now as a deputy commissioner, but as a longtime educator. What did you notice in your time in Manchester about the summer slide?
Sure. One of the things I think that's really important about when kids come back to school, it's a wonderful opportunity for schools to engage with families. And when we have some sort of summer programming, it gives kids and families opportunity to work with the school and a purpose and a reason to come back and be excited and ready to learn. And sometimes what happens is not all families have the techniques and skills that make learning fun. And so sometimes we might be doing more of a traditional, or families may be doing more of a traditional approach. And what happens is that could cause sometimes chaos or frustration in the home, because I think parents love their children and they have wonderful high expectations for their children, but they quite don't know how to make those two things happen at the same time.
So what did you see with some of the students that you worked with as a literacy specialist or a first grade teacher? You know, you said goodbye in June, you said hello in late August, early September. What did the summer slide look like with those kids?
So I think that some of the students performed a little bit lower on some of the local assessments, where when they left in the spring, we thought that they were at a certain reading level or a certain math level. And then after a couple of months, they would have extreme growth that we noticed, okay, they're back in the routine of learning, and the automaticity came back with some of their math skills or some of the word-solving skills that are necessary in reading.
How bad is the summer slide then? Are they losing 10%, 30%? There's a lot of statistics out there that purport to measure the size of this, but what do you think?
You know, I don't really want to put a number on that because each child is so unique.
That's probably smart, yeah.
Each family is really unique and they need different things. And I think most educators and schools approach it that way, that they look at the family and the child first.
Tanya, how does summer learning loss affect the students that you focus on?
Well, you have to imagine a lot of the students, especially students with special needs, there's a lot of confidence that they don't feel like learning is their strength. And So they're not the students that tend to want to go home and pick up a book and start reading or want to do some of these activities. So that is, it's really finding ways to let the student drive it and to find a love for learning or to ask questions and be in charge of what they are doing versus feeling like somebody else is controlling their learning for them.
What does the loss look like? You don't need to give individual names of kids, but just give us a couple examples that you've seen in your work, Tanya.
I think it's more kind of what Christine was talking about, is that you see the skills have that automaticity and that confidence in it. They need that time to kind of get back in and kind of refresh their memory on what they were doing. And a lot of times in special education specifically, we focus on certain skills that we're teaching them. And they have these intensive intervention times where it's really focused on those skills. And then they have a summer where they're not having that. I mean, fortunately, some students do get extended learning programs in the summer. So some of them still get those opportunities to engage in that learning during the summer, and they will see less loss.
And both you and Christine use that word, automaticity. I'm not quite sure what that means. I think I can guess, but...
It's just the quickness in being able to respond, that if you say 2 plus 2, they say 4, that they're not sitting there and having to think and go back and say, oh, I have 2 and I have 2, and I put them together, and that makes 4. So it's a quick response.
Andrew, how do you describe the summer slide? Is it as dire as some of the headlines make you believe? There's all sorts of statistics. Kids lose 20% of their reading ability, 25% in math. Lower-income kids are, 30% more at risk. I'm throwing these statistics out there because there's a lot of analysts who make you think that this is measurable and that it's big.
Sure. So one thing is just to broaden the picture out a little bit. So when we talk about summer slide or potential summer loss in learning, that is considering the kind of learning that is recognized by academic achievement tests and the kind of learning that is prioritized in schools. It's not the only kind of learning out there. So one of the things I think that is really important to keep in mind when we talk about summer slide is, what are the kinds of learning that become more prominent in the summer? And how can schools not only recognize those forms of learning, but incorporate them into the academic activities that are taking place from fall to spring?
Oh, wow, that's really interesting. So give us a little bit more on that. What are you talking about?
Sure. So, for example, during the summer, many kids, and this is true, and so especially important for New Hampshire, this is true especially in rural areas, many kids have the opportunity to observe some of the activities that are taking place in their communities. This might be work. This might be community events, leisure, that kind of thing. And not only observe, but also take part and make contributions to those activities. So one of the powerful forms of, and so I'm talking about here an umbrella of different kinds of activities that we might call informal learning. So one of the powerful aspects of informal learning is the ability to learn with purpose and also to be able to make contributions to the things that are happening. So that purpose might be, pitching in with my family who, is taking advantage of good summer weather to repair a part of the house, right? So when we look carefully at activities like that, they involve mathematics, they involve budgeting, they involve all different kinds of skills. And, there's just lots of opportunities to do things like that in the summer, and they are opportunities for schools to maybe enhance those kinds of activities and to teach kids how to bridge between academic topics and some of these topics that they have access to in the summer.
So don't discount the learning that isn't necessarily measurable by reading tests and math tests. That example you gave about helping to repair a house, that's learning also.
It is, yeah. And we could find ways to measure it and find ways to be a little bit more precise about how we describe it. But right now, there are a few efforts to really pay attention to that kind of thing.
Okay, so, and I know you both want to jump in too. I do have to ask you, though, a lot of kids, especially those whose parents are working, they don't have the opportunity to do these cool projects, working on the farm, working on the house, going on these cool vacations. A lot of them are, you know what I'm going to say, Andrew, they're going to sit home and play video games during the summer. Is that learning?
Well, in the most general sense, it is, right? But it's probably not the end point of what we might value in learning. So it's a play. So if kids are already motivated to play video games, then let's start there, right? Let's figure out what about video games do they enjoy? Maybe they talk with their friends about video games, and maybe it includes some degree of autonomy. They're making decisions about what they do, which is not always the case in schools. So let's design activities that allow them to interact with their friends in ways that have them choosing the things that they really care about. So video games can teach us something about what's valuable to kids, and we can design from there.
Go ahead, Christine, and then Tanya. Yeah.
OK, Okay, I think that the Department of Education has taken approach. We have a new law that was passed, and we have play-based kindergarten that's happening. And one of the things we'll be doing a lot of workshops during the summer and in the future. But one of the things that came across is how work versus play. When students are or children of families are looking at a project or something at home, if there's different ways that they can look at it, work or play. Often, if you're giving them a worksheet, they see that as work. It's adult evaluation. It's not something that's fun. Where if you are at a grocery store and you ask them to add two of the items that are something's enjoyable to them, they'll are more willing to do the learning, and they're active and they're participating in something. So that's learning everywhere. Learning can happen at all different times in different places in different settings.
How do you feel about Andrew's comment that we need to maybe pull away from this idea of summer learning loss? You did 80% on reading before the summer. You did 70% after the summer. This idea of sort of metrics and measurement, Andrew seems to be saying, let's open it up a little bit more, look at it a little more holistically.
Yeah, I think that that's a fantastic idea. I think there's learning everywhere. Learn everywhere is something that's important to the Department of Education. And I think what we have now in the older grades is extended learning opportunities where students can earn credits. And on Thursday, we're going to hopefully have the State Board of Education be able to issue credits some programs that are vetted through the process. They're voting on that on Thursday.
Wow, extended learning opportunities. Mm-hmm. I might ask you a little bit more about that later, Christine, but Tanya, go ahead.
I just want to also add that I want to go back to what you said, Andrew, about how sometimes we frame learning, it's reading, writing, and math. And we don't always value that. Some of the things that you shared that they could do in families is also building skills that are just as valuable to students. Problem solving, creativity, collaboration. And these are skills that students can take and will help them in anything that they want to do in the future. And it allows them to still engage in reading, writing, and math at the same time.
So here's a big question then, and I'll ask all of you, starting with you, Tanya. Some people who have written about the summer slide, and boy, all you have to do is Google summer slide, and whew, there's a lot out there. Some people have said, look, the elephant in the room is we just shouldn't have this giant 10-week summer vacation. What do you think about that?
You know, it was interesting because I was looking at, spent some time reading just to get my brain wrapped around this topic. And they said, even if we got rid of the summer, those 10 weeks in the summer and we did a full year, they're still in school the same amount of time and they're still having breaks. So there's still these opportunities for breaks. But I think it's changing, using the summer to kind of create the community comes together and thinks, how can we support children in learning when they're in school and when they're out of school? And I think sometimes we say, oh, it's 10 weeks, but it's also really important for children to have unstructured time and not just structured time. There's structured time for learning, but there's a lot of learning, like you said, that happens when things are not set and structured. And it teaches children how to engage or how to problem solve or how to entertain themselves. And then I think that one of the things our students are expecting now is they're so used to having things that quickly entertain them that, you know, the teacher says what to do or I have my video game and it entertains me right away. And having that ability to kind of facilitate and figure out, what do I want to do or how can I be creative or, you know, let me just go outside and to have that opportunity as well.
So there is a value, you think, mm-hmm. to a stretch of downtime. Maybe it's 10 weeks, maybe it's not. But
yes, but to have some downtime.
What do you think, Andrew?
Well, so and I'll make a comment here that I think Tanya would agree with. I would just want to frame the issue less in terms of unstructured and structured time and more think about how different kinds of time can be structured and all of them structured. Right. So mm-hmm. we have the structure that accompanies academic learning and most of us are very familiar with that. But leisure time and work time and community event time and all of these things, these are also structured times. It's just that the structure is maybe common sense to us and we don't see it. So I think it is worth, and this is especially the case for parents and educators, it's worth paying attention. What is the structure of that time? What seems to make it work, right? Why are kids motivated in that time in ways that they might not be in school? And can we mirror the structure of that time in ways that can then support academic learning? So you know, these different kinds of time can be really, really inspirational for different educational programming and things like that.
For instance, give me a couple, for instance, instances of those educational programs that you'd like to see during this unstructured time?
Sure. So let me bring an example that I think would be really common in many rural communities of New Hampshire. So one of the biggest movements right now that many listeners are probably really familiar with is STEM learning, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. When you look at STEM learning from an academic angle, it can look like certain things. It looks like schools, but, you know, with lots of interesting materials and projects and that kind of thing. But STEM learning also takes place in communities. So people repair their cars, people are blacksmiths, you know, that kind of thing. And that work context has a different structure than school context. So one of the main differences is that in schools, learning is often the end goal, right? So we do activities in order to learn. When we work as a blacksmith, for example, we're learning all the time, but learning isn't the end goal, right? It's creating things, it's serving customers, and that kind of thing. So when learning is the means to an end rather than the end itself, that changes a lot, and sometimes I think for the good.
Well, and that sounds great, Andrew, but you know, there's a lot of single parent households. I'm in both parents work. I work, my husband works, so we don't have time to take our kids to the auto mechanic or the blacksmith shop. So, what do you suggest at the community level for those many single parent families or families where, you know, both parents are working during the summer, we're not teachers, we don't have the summer off?
Yeah, so most of what I'm talking about comes from my research on household chores, and that's something that happens in every family. So, for example, you know, parents or even some older siblings cook every day, right? And so there's so many academic concepts kind of, and pardon the pun here, but baked into cooking, right? So measurement and, yeah, I mean, even real social concepts like, you know, what are people's preferences? How can we satisfy these different preferences in a single meal? Considerations about nutrition, all those kinds of things. So you don't have to have a blacksmith in your community. Every family has opportunities for this.
Well, that's a great example, actually. Go ahead, Christine.
Yeah, and I also think that now being in the age of information and having technology easily accessible, I think we really have to consider our education system evolving into more personalized learning, where what Andrew was speaking of is more student agency, depending on age, where children feel empowered about having choices on what their pathway is going to be and what their career pathway is going to be in the end, and allowing that inside the schools. I think that would help students achieve more.
Achieve more, especially over the summer, Christine?
Over the summer, because there can be opportunities or programs that, for instance, the parents could give them a choice on what they want to do over the summer. That might be something that, if even a simple choice, like, do you want baseball or soccer? And if they pick what they want, the student probably or child will probably have more, be more excited to go.
So one expert on this summer slide issue called summer the most unequal time in America. Christine, to you first, but anybody jump in. How much does summer learning loss affect lower income kids more than middle and upper income kids?
I would say it affects them a lot more because sometimes they don't have access to programs or books or materials. I know that in Manchester they do a fantastic job with the bookmobile. We also have some opportunities where students can go to some of our nutrition programs. And I think that I think that there's not as many community activities for kids of lower income to go to.
Yeah, I have read, and I do worry about kids who don't have parents at home, and I'm talking all incomes, that they do just sit there and stare at their phones or stare at the television all day.
Yeah, and I think that the schools do a pretty good job about reaching out to some of the agencies. I know Manchester, there's a Salvation Army, and they have a camp in the summer, so a lot of the kids go there. There's Mayu Camp. So there's a lot of connections with the schools to help children have some time with good role models and good positive adults.
And some of those programs, I'm guessing, are not super expensive. There's a sliding scale for lower income
families
and so forth.
Yep. Your community is pretty good about taking care of people.
Tanya?
I would also, besides the effect on low SES, I would also talk about access and opportunity with rural versus urban.
Absolutely.
Because I know in the part of the state, the Monadnock region, that there's a lot of smaller rural communities where there isn't transportation. And sometimes that access, or even the fact that there may not be the best Wi-Fi, or they may not have some of the internet or technology at home, and that can also affect their access and opportunity. And I think those variables also kind of create barriers for students with low SES.
SES is socioeconomic
status.
Yeah. So this is an issue, especially in your area, perhaps in the Monadnock region, and probably in the North Country, where there are these little towns and there isn't great transportation.
No.
And if mom and dad are working, they can't take you to the enrichment program 20 miles away.
They don't. And I think it is a big issue, transportation. And I think also the fact that also within those, the communication maybe between schools and family about what is actually available to them. I think that there are a lot of community members raising money and trying to find opportunity, and that families may not realize that, or they may not also realize the opportunities like tickets you can get at the library and some of those things, which also can be buried. You know, going to the Museum of Science, you have to have a car. You also have to have time. You also have to have, I mean, there's a lot of barriers that some of the rural communities may face.
What's the way around that?
Oh, those are the things that we're trying to figure out now. And I think that one of the things is getting the community involved. I think that sometimes we want to say it solely falls on the parents or it falls on the schools. And really, I think the big thing is it needs to be the community coming together and finding solutions to these issues and maybe finding ways to gain transportation and opportunity.
Andrew, what are your thoughts on the income gap and how that affects summer learning loss?
Yeah, so the most recent data on this are actually not that conclusive at all. So the I think the idea of there being, so what we're talking about here is the achievement gap between different social class groups or even race or ethnicity groups. One of the earliest studies that showed that summer was a consequential time for the achievement gap was a study called the Beginning School Study. This was done in Baltimore in the early 80s. And they indeed found that there were big differences that became larger during the summer. However, there were a lot of problems with the data that were used, with the tests that were used in that study. And so Paul von Hippel is really at UT Austin has really done the best work on this. And what he finds using more modern data sets is that achievement gaps, when there are gaps, really start much earlier. So they start around age five, and they don't grow. In fact, they may even shrink as you know, as sort of the years progress, basically from kindergarten to grade eight. So the consequences for understanding the summer slide then are kind of interesting. It's the summer slide, at least for achievement gaps. Now, all kids seem to, in terms of academic-only learning, seem to slow a little bit in the summer. Now, maybe if they're learning other kinds of things, we would be comfortable with that, you know, that slowdown. But in terms of social class differences growing, not necessarily the case based on modern findings.
Coming up, more on how to slow down the summer slide, what it looks like here in New Hampshire. We'll talk more in a moment. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, how to stop the summer slide. As vacation season approaches, school districts, libraries, and the State Department of Education are promoting ways to prevent students from losing too much academic ground over the summer months. We're looking at those efforts, also who's most affected by summer learning loss, and the idea that maybe we need to redefine this whole idea of summer slide. Let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can give us a call at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-6477. NHPR. Christine Brennan is here, Deputy Commissioner at the New Hampshire Department of Education and a longtime educator in Manchester, along with Andrew Coppins, Assistant Professor of Learning Sciences at UNH, and Tanya Sturtz, Associate Dean of the School of Arts, Education, and Culture at Keene State College. She's also an Associate Professor of Special Education. And before we go to our listeners, all of you, I want to ask this question, and Christine, to you first, because you addressed this recently in a big news release you had on resources that the Department of Education has out there on the summer slide. You said stopping the summer slide falls mainly on parents. Some parents listening today will agree. They're already typing out their reading lists. But some parents may be saying, I'm tired of nagging about homework and grades and schoolwork. So what's your message to those parents, Christine, who are thinking, I too would like a break from all this?
Yeah, I think that just embedding routines that promote good learning habits, and they can be really fun. So they could go to the library or the bookstore. We're partnering with the libraries right now, many of the communities, to have reading logs and make sure that they're connected to the school. It could be something as simple as talking about books and giving book descriptions so that books become enticing and something that kids want to do.
The libraries all have fantastic programs. I shouldn't say they all do. The one in Concord does for sure. And I remember the local bank had a summer reading program where if you read 10 books, they would even put $50, I think, in your bank account. So there were sort of community incentives like that. But I guess what's the message to the parent who really just doesn't have time to do any of the things that you talk about? What else is there for those parents?
Yeah, I think that all parents have to find those opportunities. And if they are struggling, they can reach out to other parents to see what they're doing to make sure that learning is something that's an important part of students' lives.
What do you think, Andrew?
So a couple of things that were just mentioned were based in an idea of partnership. And I think that's really key. So if we place all of the onus on parents, I think we're just not going to get very far. So partnerships between parents and other parents is a great solution. So, community blocks can get together and say, okay, I'm going to organize something this week. You organize something next week. Libraries and parents, libraries and schools can work together. So for me, that's the baseline criterion is what are the different kind of institutions and parents that are involved in trying to keep learning going and enrich what learning is already taking place in schools.
Well, we have an email to that effect, what you just mentioned, Andrew. Ginny in Center Harbor says, I hope that we can bring back communities that are safe enough to allow for free-range children. I remember following the bookmobile as if it were the ice cream truck. We went there on our own in groups, and wandering around the neighborhood always offered some adventure. One parent was a carpenter. One mother always had a crew of kids making cookies. Ginny says, we were independent but safe and secretly supervised. My children, she says, had a similar experience, but I would worry about letting my grandchildren roam blocks away from home on their own. Ginny says, I am critical of helicopter parents, but understand their concerns. Ginny, thank you so much, and I'd love everybody's thoughts on this. Go ahead, Tanya.
Well, and it's finding opportunities to give them the freedom to explore, but I don't think that that freedom to explore is going to limit their ability to learn in the summer, and that a lot of times I think of my own children. They want to go outside and they want to be free, but they want me to be there. And I think they like to have that adult or somebody in there that engages in those learnings with them, and it's not just them going off on their own. And there's a lot of things that opportunities that we can give children that allow them to have the freedom to kind of be free range, like within a limit, and slowly build up that confidence to give them more freedom and opportunity.
Thank you for the email, Ginny. And Stacy in Ashland writes, as I sign up my kids for a variety of specialty summer camps, I can't help but wonder how much the summer slide affects low-income families. I love that my kids experience new things over the summer, but there are so many families that can't pay for these camps or transport their kids to them. I know too many kids who just play video games all summer because they don't have access to summer programming. We talked about this a little bit earlier, all of you, but Andrew and anybody else, I would love for you to respond to Stacy's email. She's right. There are lots of really cool opportunities for families who can afford it.
Yeah, so I think one of the main things that we can do as educators is to coach parents in seeing opportunities for learning that they do have access to. So that requires us being more flexible about what counts for learning in our eyes, and supplementing parents' I think insights and intuitions with new ideas. So it doesn't necessarily have to be a fancy summer camp, although those camps are great. It can be things that are already going on in the community, and then we can, again, in partnership, we as educators can work with parents to say, okay, can we deepen the learning that's taking place here and provide parents tools for doing that.
And Christine, that gets into that big press release you put out a couple weeks ago on the sort of stepped up efforts that you're making at the Department of Education to help parents with the summer slide.
And to Andrew's point as well, I think New Hampshire is an absolutely great state, and in a lot of places it just offers such learning anyways, be it at the White Mountains or some of our state parks where families can go. And although it's not a state, although it's not a program, it's an adventure for a family to go on where lots of great memories are created and learning is happening. And parents can then narrate their day. And, you know, I just want people to know that just talking and families talking is communication and talking is the precursor to reading and writing. And so the more that family members are talking to one another about each other's day, about the things that they've done, that alone will help with reading and writing because parents can then expand vocabulary. So these are just skill sets that we need to make available, and we need to make sure that we are educating the families as well, everybody.
Go ahead, Tanya. Yeah.
And I think we forget that we don't allow our children to ask questions and guide their learning. And I always tell my kids, ask questions, ask good questions, because that allows them when they ask, like, why, for example, why does a bee make a buzzing sound? That's a great question.
It is a great question.
Let's go find out. How can we find out? Oh, okay, let's go find some books. And maybe we can you know, watch some videos. And maybe we can do observations. But allowing them to ask questions it's an easy way for families to engage in learning without it being learning. It's just an activity.
The only thing I would add is that, again, like similar points that we've raised, it's important. So if we talk about conversations and talk and shared language and things, it's really important, I think, to not allow all the different kinds of conversations that are taking place and all the different kinds of language that kids have access to become what I might call schoolified, right? So there are really interesting stories that family members share, especially across generations. And those are stories that kids don't necessarily have access to in schools. And if we schoolify those conversations, that kind of undermines the richness of those conversations a bit. So parents
can. What do you mean by that, schoolify, Andrew?
Well, so school has conventional ways of doing school. I don't mean to put everything in a bucket or be overly critical. I'm not at all. But the kind of question and answer formats, and sometimes the test formats that become very popular, those are really important formats. But if all conversation and all language that kids have access to comes to resemble those formats, then we really reduce the depth of what kids have access to. Kids should learn from telling jokes and see sort of the nuance in different stories that people are telling. And and I think this is behind the idea of kind of helicopter parenting, is that is this sort of imposed, overstructured aspect of increasingly a lot of kids' lives. So, I just think we see the richness in the conversations that are already taking place, and maybe point some things out to kids when they have opportunities to observe and take part.
Christine, a couple weeks ago, you put out a big news release about certain resources, websites, partnerships that the state is stepping up this year to help parents with the summer slide. What are some of those? And we've got links on our website, too, by the way. So if you're driving down the highway and can't write all this down, it's fine.
Sure. So I think one of the things that I'm excited about is the Lexiles website, where parents can look at what their child's reading level is, and it will give them an independent book that they can read. And I think that that's really an important tool, because I think that when you look at how parents are approaching reading, kids can go home and they can read it independently, but you want to make sure that they have choice in their reading. There's times where kids need to be having books that are at their reading level so they can practice the skills and get better at it. And then sometimes there's a time for kids to have books that are above their reading level so they can just peruse, look at the pictures. Reading can come at looking at maps. But this tool will help parents, if a parent wants to hear a child read, hone in on what's their level. Because I think what we want to give is kids lots of successful experience, because successful experiences in reading breeds confidence. It improves their self-esteem. So I think when parents are giving kids materials, this Lexile tool will help.
What is the Lexile tool? That was unfamiliar to me until yesterday.
So it's an algorithm that's formed on a book, and they take the sentence length, the vocabulary, the complexity of a book, and they put a reading level on it. So sometimes it can be related to the statewide assessment score of where they score, and sometimes the teachers use it. That's what the Lexile is.
And so you go to this website, you click on it, what do you do, Christine?
And then you can put in a book title. So say your child's reading this book and you're like, oh, what level is this? You can put the book title in and it will tell you what level they're at. Vice versa, you can put in the reading level that your child's reading at from this number, and then it will pop up a list of books for you
that might be of interest to your child and at their reading level.
Exactly.
What about math? Because I have read that math loss is worse than reading loss.
Yeah, we have one of the math programs, a summer math summer math challenge, and this is a free six-week math skills program, and it's designed for students who have just completed first through eighth grade in a math curriculum. So parents who enroll their children online are going to receive a daily email. And this is going to start on June 17th.
All right. We've got links on our website, nhpr.
Yep. And there are puzzle games and activities and lots of things that that families can do with that tool. But also, I don't want families to forget that something simple as playing Yahtzee at home is just as fun.
Let's take a call. And this is Rick in Nashua. Hi, Rick. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, how you doing?
Okay.
Yeah, I know you guys mean well. I listen to your show a lot, and it's hard because these people are talking about almost like this fantasy world where people live in houses and there's two original parents, and you know they're there while fix up the house. They learn mathematics by measuring stuff. The majority of the people in this state. You have kids living with half brothers, half sisters, one parent, a stranger every 6 months. It rains most of the time. They're living in rundown, moldy, lead-paint apartments. They're paying 80% of their salary to try to live because of this monopoly these landlords and real estate and builders are living on and are doing in the city. It's hard to listen to you guys when it seems like they're just in this fantasy. This is not what's going on at all. We're in a nightmare.
Well, and Rick, I really appreciate the call, and I've been trying to ask about what about low-income families, what about families where there's only one parent around. So I really appreciate the point. Maybe we're not hitting it hard enough. Andrew, I'm looking at you first. He's absolutely right. There are families where there's no internet access. Parents are working three jobs. There's only one parent. There's all sorts of chaos in the home. We've done tons of shows on DCYF and some of the just really difficult, difficult situations that kids find themselves in. A lot of trauma. So thank you so much for the call, Rick. So I guess we need to hone in on this a little bit harder.
Yeah. So the point that the caller raises is, I think, precisely the justification for looking beyond academic modes of learning and into sort of informal modes of learning. So the sun doesn't have to be shining, and you don't have to have a lot of money in order to see opportunities to learn around you. And so one of the main reasons for acknowledging different forms of learning and figuring out a way to sort of build those into the kinds of learning that schools are trying to foment and support is that it's accessible to families who are under economic stress. It's accessible to families where older siblings are doing a lot of caregiving. I agree with some of the points, but I disagree with the idea that it's sort of a fantasy world.
Rick, thank you so much for the call. You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. What do you think, Tanya? A compelling call from Rick saying, look, you're living in a fantasy world. This is not, you know, Ozzie and Harriet.
Well, to be honest, what he shared is not only a barrier in the summer slide, it's a barrier to learning during the academic year. One of the biggest things that are happening in the schools is the trauma and, you know, the trauma that's happening at home, the situation students are living in. They can't just walk up to a building, leave the luggage outside and walk in. Life doesn't work like that. But I think that with all that is how do we take this and find opportunities for students to realize, first, acknowledge what they're going through and for them to understand that we hear them and that there are opportunities and access for them. And it's finding those and finding ways, finding books that they may be able to connect to or finding what their interests are in and things that they could take home and share with their siblings. I think that that is where that community piece and especially the school making the connection to families and providing opportunities would help in the situations that he was talking about.
Go ahead, Christine. You used to work at the Beach Street School, which was a low-income school.
Mm-hmm. I so appreciate the caller's response to what we're talking about. And yes, I think a lot of teachers will have that same concern or worry when summer happens. There are some concerns and worries. But I can't help the caller's, his call reminded me of Robert Putnam's book, Our Kids, A Nation in Crisis. And I think that the summer is an opportunity for kids to go beyond the school day, find great mentors. That we've got the Boys and Girls Club. We have the Boys and Girls Club. We have the YMCA. I know that the Charitable Foundation has lots of opportunities and programs that they've donated to, so that kids can have access to that. But regardless of the social status of a family, families love their children, and they want wholeheartedly to do what's best by them. And I think that making sure that the school is connected to the family and sharing the resources and making sure that they're connected to the community is ultimately important. And it's the community that is going to help lift up everybody.
Go ahead, Andrew.
So some of the things that I, and this is continuing to respond to the caller's really kind of provocative and interesting comments. So some of the aspects of learning that I mentioned earlier around the importance of learning with purpose, purpose that's connected to community, the idea of having opportunities to make a contribution. So some of those seemingly idealistic aspects of learning that can take place in the summer, research that found those things were based in communities in extreme conditions of poverty. So migrant worker communities in California who had immigrated from Mexico, for example. So it's not a requirement to need lush economic circumstances in a family in order to support learning.
All right. Well, we'll pick up on that thread in just a moment. I also want to ask all of you about the summer melt. This has to do with first-generation college students and what happens to some of them over the summer. And we'll take more of your calls. So stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
Recently on The Exchange, transgender panelists answer a listener's question about how to talk about those times before their child transitioned.
Just because they've come out as trans does not lessen that experience. Do you still own those memories? And I would say to any parent, those memories are yours of your child. It's just being thoughtful both to what you need as a parent and understanding that your first priority is to make sure that your child is loved.
The Exchange is your place for New Hampshire conversations. Weekday mornings at 9, only on NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, summer learning loss, or the summer slide. We're hearing about efforts being made by school districts, libraries, the State Department of Education to reduce or even prevent this. Let's hear from you. Your personal experiences, questions, critiques are welcome. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Or you can call in 1-800-892-6477. Very quickly, I wanted to ask all of you about something I read about just yesterday. Not so much the summer slide, summer learning loss, but something called the summer melt. And Tanya, I'm going to turn to you. This is where first-generation college students, they get accepted to college, and then they melt over the summer, and they don't end up showing up for the first day of their freshman year. What happens?
Right now we're going through orientation. And at Kingsley College, we have like a 41% first-generation college population.
So, really? Wow.
Yeah. So we work a lot with first-generation families. And a lot of it has to do with access and opportunity as well, is that they're not quite sure of how to make the connections or the resources or to make sure they filled out all the financial aid or got their classes signed up. And so there's a lot of these things that they when you come from a family that has people who went to college, you're like, oh, did you do this, 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 this? They don't have that. So sometimes they slip through that melt. They slip through the cracks. So it's really encouraging those students and their families, connect, go to the colleges, ask questions, make sure that everything is covered, and go to the orientations where they can ensure that everything is what you're supposed to have done is done.
Well, and I can appreciate that because yeah. I'm not a first generation college family, but even with my older son who's in college, there's all these forms to fill out, and they were quite confusing because this is the first time we've sent someone to college. So it keeps changing. There's new requirements and so forth. So I can see why some young people might just melt and go, oh, I can't deal
with
it,
too much.
Or I missed the deadline or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I did not know that statistic about Keene State. That's very interesting.
Yes.
Go ahead, Andrew.
So at like Keene State, so at University of New Hampshire, our first-gen population is above 30%. And so this is an issue that we think about and sort of wrestle with a lot. And a point that I'd just like to add is that many, and this is true, I think, especially of youth that are coming from rural communities, is that going away from your community to college is a big step. And it's a step that is a bit of a balance. So once there's the opportunity to go to college and, the professional opportunities and doors that are opened there, but it also has the potential to place youth in, call it sort of conflict with their communities. So if nobody in my family has gone to college and the people around me haven't gone to college, well, when I go away and then come back, am I still going to belong in the way that I did before? And so I think we have to consider that and sort of the consequences for identity that are big questions for first-generation students.
That's really interesting. Okay. Yeah. Go ahead, Tanya. Yeah,
and I've done some research with my colleague, Dr. Hux, on first-year experience and also with that transition to college. And that is a big piece to it, is that that sense of homesickness and their supports, they are so closely connected to the community. It is a big transition for them to come to a new place and to create a new social network and to realize that they can have those supports there as well. And that is part of the summer melt, too, is that that fear of stepping into a new situation that is new to them. And how are they going to handle some of these situations?
Let's go back to our listeners. And Carol's calling from Holderness. Hi, Carol. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, good morning. I'm a volunteer with the Got Lunch program for Interlakes in school district in Meredith. And both our Got Lunch program and the Laconia Got Lunch program deliver, along with the food, magazines and books to the kids a couple times during the summer. And it's under the auspices of a charitable organization called Altrusa. They provide the material. So that's one. I mean, it's small, but it's one little bit of reach out in terms of providing reading materials to the kids.
So you deliver lunch, Carol. They don't have to come to the school to get it.
That's right. We bring every Monday, we pack and then bring a sack full of lunch fixings to houses all over Meredith, Center Harbor, and Sandwich. And there's Got Lunch programs in Ashland. There's a huge one in Laconia, which is where the whole idea got started. And they're in lots of different places in the state, I think, at this point.
Wow. And along with those lunches, you bring reading materials.
Yeah. A couple times a summer, we include reading materials. And they're the kind of educational magazines like Jack and Jill and that sort of stuff that,
sure.
I mean, it can take a kid a while to get through that. So it's something.
Well, Carol, good for you. Thank you so much for calling. Go ahead, Christine.
Thank you so much, Carol. And I also am very well aware of Altrusa. I have a friend, Diane Robinson, who's on that committee, and she tells me about the fantastic volunteer work that organization does. And you might want to give a shout out to them because I often go to their plant sale and many of the things that they do up in that area. I just want everyone to know also we have at the Department of Education an organization providing meals to students throughout the summer, as well as a link to a terrific new smartphone app called The Range. And this nonprofit group called Tech Group has compiled a list of all of our USDA's summer food service programs. And this will be displayed where free meals for kids will be available throughout the summer. And I know that this is an opportunity, again, to see those students, make sure they're talking about books, make sure if there are books or you can connect with another community service that you can have books available during this time. I'll actually be out at Beach Street next week at one of their programs, and I'm so looking forward to seeing the students and some of the family members. I terribly miss them.
Yeah, and again, you know, nutrition, there's a strong link between that connection, nutrition from the schools and coming in and the learning. And Carol talked about that. Her program sounds great. I do wonder, though, I don't want to sound like a broken record, but as we keep talking about, you know, websites and apps, there are lower income families who don't have access to the internet, who don't have phones, who don't have good computers at home, if computers at all. So I'm just wondering about reaching out to those families, Christine.
Yeah, and I think that there are things that are going on throughout different communities, and I'm going to talk about Wendy Perrin. I think she was on your program last week, but she had was the first person to get the bookmobile going back from some donations, and that is something that is a huge draw for that community. And Scholastic has donated many of the books for that bookmobile. But that's an opportunity. I know that there's lots of dignitaries that go to the events just to add to the draw. And that's where kids can then see role models and can see people that really care about them and have those kind of conversations and make sure that they're safe over the summer.
And we got that email earlier from someone who said she used to follow the bookmobile around town. Thank you for that call. And let's go to Lynn in Jackson. Hi, Lynn. You're on the air. Welcome.
Oh, well, thank you. I hope this isn't off topic at this point, but I wanted to mention that in my youth in the 60s, my son's youth in the 90s, we had days we simply didn't have to do anything. And I want to, you know, do a shout-out for those kids that get up, get dressed, and make a decision about what they're going to do. And if they decide to go sit by the lake or go sit by a pond for the day, that's what they do. The ability to chill and get away from that frenzy of activity that you have the whole school year.
Well, Lynn, thank you very much for the call. Andrew, I'm going to throw that to you with the caveat. I think everybody here would say, yeah, that's awesome. You decided what you were going to do. It does seem that a lot of students today will choose to get up and not get dressed and sit in their pajamas again in front of a screen. And, you know, they're not getting out and sitting in front of the pond.
Yeah, so the first thing is I just want to agree that the importance of downtime and unplugging. I mean, I have enough challenges myself in unplugging my phone and unplugging the phone from my eyes and, you know, and all that kind of thing. But so that's really important. The second is let's ask some questions about when kids don't seem to be motivated to, you know, get out of bed or get dressed or do much more than play video games. Why is that, right? Is it because they are stressed? Is it because they're sort of overwhelmed, right? And so that's really what we need to focus on rather than what they happen to be doing at the surface level. The other thing that I would say is, you know, go sit by a pond. The temptation is to think that nothing's happening there. But in fact, I would guess that there's a lot happening there, right? There's certainly a lot happening in the natural world, right? There's water, you know, going by,
fish,
plants, trees, right? All that kind of thing. So again, if the impulse is to go do that kind of activity, we can, you know, we can build on that interest in really subtle and not overwhelming ways. You know?
Well, and she's right. There's a lot of research now that shows what happens to the brain when you do have unstructured time. And I'm talking not unstructured time staring at a screen, but unstructured time where your brain is allowed to do whatever it wants to do on its own.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, I mean, the same
is
true.
The neural connections being made.
Yeah, the same is true of physical exercise. You know, you go do a hard workout and then, you know, really the strength building happens when you're resting, right? So I think it's an apt metaphor for cognitive growth as well.
Well, Lynn, it's really good to hear from you. You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. If there were one thing, Tanya, you could just snap your fingers and fix the whole summer learning loss issue, which, as Andrew has told us, it's a little more complicated and nuanced than just, you know, you got an 80 on the test in June and a 70 in August. But if you could just snap your fingers and improve it, what would you do?
Yeah, to be honest, considering where I live right now, I think a big piece to help in that would be access to transportation.
Really? Wow.
That is one of the biggest barriers of getting around and having access to some of those opportunities that I think would help in, the region that I live in. So, and also money to fund families to be able to have opportunities. I'd say those two.
So a lot of opportunities are already there, but there's no transportation or funding for those opportunities.
I would say no transportation, but limited or not as easily accessible.
That's interesting. And by the way, you teach at Keene State College. What town do you live in, if I might ask?
Oh, I live in Keene.
You live in Keene. Okay, but there are all those small towns.
There's a lot of, Keene is, the biggest area in the region. So,
yeah. How about you, Andrew, if you could just wave the wand and fix it?
I'm glad I had a second to think about that. I think the temptation is to do something in the summer. I think having a moment to think about it, I would do more during the school year than during the summer, actually. So a lot of what we're talking about when we refer to summer slide is going to sound a little jargony, but it's a really perennial issue with schools is knowledge encapsulation, right? So
How do you make it stick?
How do you make it stick?
So you don't lose it over the summer.
Yeah, and how do you make it relevant to different contexts, different people, different relationships, right? So if my guess, I suppose, is that if we did a lot more of that during the year, we'd see a lot less slide during the summer.
That's really interesting, and I had been doing some reading about that yesterday. Christine, I won't throw that big question at you. Why doesn't it stick more during the school year so we don't lose it over the summer? Instead, I'll just throw at you what I threw at the other two, which is if you could just do one thing to make this a little bit better, what would you do?
Yeah, I think it's about family engagement, schools having family engagement opportunities and making sure that that community connection is happening and the school is the hub of the community. So making sure that there's lots of outreach in that way.
Okay. All of you, thank you very much for coming in. Christine, it was good to see you. Thank you for being
Thanks.
Here.
Thanks. Great to see you, too.
Christine Brennan, Deputy Commissioner at the New Hampshire Department of Education. Andrew Coppins, good to meet you. See you again.
Thank you very much.
Andrew Coppins, Assistant Professor of Learning Sciences at UNH. And Tanya Sturtz, thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Tanya Sturtz is an Associate Dean of the School of Arts, Education, and Culture at Keene State, and also an Associate Professor of Special Education. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The producers are Ellen Grimm, Jessica Hunt, and Christina Phillips, also Ali Oshinsky. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our theme music was written by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.